fortune in vain. Sing a dirge about it, splurge about it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But if you're on the verge of
good evening. Tonight, City of Goleta Planning Commission. What day is it? Last day of June, June 30th. And would everybody join me in the pledge, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you for that. Roll call, please, clerk.
Commissioner Dressler.
Here.
Commissioner Onan.
Here.
Commissioner West.
Here.
Vice Chair Solomon.
Here.
Chair Daniels.
Present. At this time, we are going to open up the public forum for anybody who has something to say that is not on the agenda tonight. And I see no hands. And at this point, I will close the public forum. Madam Clerk, it looks like we have a few unapproved minutes. Could you go through them for us, please?
Thank you. Item A1 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission special meeting of June 2nd, 2014.
Does anybody have any discussion, please?
I'll move the minutes.
Second.
Myself and Vice Chair were absent that day.
We're going to abstain.
We will abstain. Call the vote.
Aye.
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 3-0, it passes. Next week, please.
Item A2 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission meeting of June 9th, 2014.
Thank you. Any discussion, Commission?
No discussion.
Can I get a motion, please?
I'll move the minutes.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. That goes 5-0. Next one, please. Clerk.
Thank you. Item A3 is the Planning Commission meeting minutes for the Planning Commission special meeting, June 16th, 2014.
Any Planning Commission discussion on this one?
I'll move to approve.
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye, please.
Aye.
Aye.
And I'll abstain. I was absent.
In fact, you were? Aye. That's 4-0-1. Is that it? Is there one more?
Nope, that's it.
That's it.
That's it.
Okay. Moving on to the discussion of the day. Can you please enter this into the record, clerk?
Yes. Item B is the Zoning Ordinance Project Module 3, Part 2, Regulations Applying to Multiple Districts.
Thank you. Steph?
Good evening, Chair Daniels and Planning Commissioners. Tonight's my pleasure to bring forward the third module, Part 2, for you on our new zoning ordinance that we're in the thick of preparing. And I just wanted to step back just a second and look big picture. We broke out the zoning ordinance project into three modules, and the first one was administration and permits, and we've reviewed that, and then now we are taking the second crack at it based on public feedback and your comments. And then we moved on to the zoning districts, and same thing with the zoning districts, and now we're in the regulations applying to multiple zones. And that is kind of the detail that is pretty heady stuff to go through. So we broke it out into multiple modules. And tonight we have our consultant here, Michael Diet from Diet and Bhatia, to provide you with a presentation. And we have at least one more module coming your way. We haven't talked about it. We may do a little bit at your next meeting in July and then have another special meeting in August. That way we'll have finished the complete the module and we can go back and work on an entire draft code. But tonight we're going to focus on the issues that are in the staff report, and I will turn the presentation over to Mr. Diet, noting that you do have staff resources here. So for our conversation and back and forth, the planning director is here, Jennifer Carmen, I'm here, Michael Diet is here, and then we also have staff in the audience. Andy Newkirk's one of them. Thank you.
Mr. Diet, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to again be back here to be working with you on the regulations that we think help implement the general plan. I'm not going to read the purpose, but for those who are new, this is the idea to carry out the policies in the general plan and ensure that the vision that the community has in place will be implemented through the zoning regulations. And what we have done is, as Ann mentioned, break Module 3 into three parts, making it much more understandable. And you've already looked at site landscaping, parking, and loading. And tonight we'll be doing the middle part, the coastal regulations, demolition, relocation, coastal energy facilities, the environmentally sensitive habitats, lighting, performance standards, floodplain management, and tree protection. Still to come are regulations that are directly centered on the housing element policies, and you've been hearing about the housing element update separately, and it may even make sense to take this next package of affordable housing density bonuses, inclusionary provisions, and reasonable accommodations for persons with disabilities as a clean, separate package that then would be have that same kind of open house I've been having with the community, and then that would be packaged with the housing element update, and it gets sent to Sacramento for a quick a look, and then you'll get some advice from Sacramento. The last package then would be the signed standards for special uses and telecommunications facilities, which would be, again, three major topics, and dealing at that same time with nonconforming use provisions, what happens for the uses that you inherited from the county that may not conform. So that's the larger picture, and then as we hear from people, and we've been having very good open house meetings in the hour before these meetings start to get ideas and reactions informally. In the coastal zone development section, we've got really good guidance from the general plan. And the purpose is just to make sure that whatever we're doing is fully reflective of the Coastal Act and the local coastal program that you have in place. The city did benefit from a grant from the state, and there'll be some concurrent work and additional fine-tuning of the local coastal land use plan, part of the coastal program, that will be proceeding concurrently, but we're in effect a little bit ahead of it. As you know from the first module, we did the regulations for coastal permits, and now we have the additional standards and provisions, and they set in place the limits on shoreline development, no structures or seawalls, except as needed for the staircases and public access, structure siting standards, taking account of bluff retreat and the issue of sea level rise, and look at shoreline protection, not only the issues related to erosion control, but also dealing with runoff and stormwater drainage, and lastly, view preservation. So in a sense, this was an easy section to write because we had such good language in the general plan, and we followed it. We had a similar sort of relatively easy task with coastal access, where you want to ensure that the public access, both they're called vertical access ways coming down from the bluff to the beach, and lateral access, which goes along the bluff top connecting the vertical access ways, all work. And we put in place then the access requirements that are needed and set out the specific standards to make sure not only that the total width of the access way is right, but that there be a good clear zone, that the pedestrian pathway is wide enough and safe enough and secure enough. And we affirm the historic prescriptive right, where if people have been using that particular trail down to the beach for years, then there's been what's called a de facto dedication to public use. It goes back to some cases in Santa Cruz in the 70s. And lastly, we affirm when you have to provide new public access. And it's a highly prescriptive section, and I think it does the job, and it makes sure that through the guarantees required that you'll get the public access, and it will be access then in perpetuity and maintained so that it's kept in good shape for you. We included as well some provisions on demolition and relocation, and they're not just simply what happens when you want to demolish a building. And what you really want to know is what's going to be in its place, so you don't have someone who starts in, undertakes a demolition, and then you're left with a vacant lot, and then, oh, we really had in mind this. You want to look at the whole package and look at what happens if the building is a historic building under CEQA, which is 50 years or more of age. Now, some would say, no, there are many buildings that were built before 1964, so that this is a fairly wide net. Well, that's why the general plan said the city should really have an inventory of historic resources and look at those that are important. And so instead of having, you know, thousands of buildings that might be covered by this chapter, you'd get it down to those that are important. Well, the council hasn't yet authorized and budgeted that. So we'll be clear that when that inventory is in place, this section would not apply to all those buildings. It would apply to the buildings that are on the inventory. But we have to start somewhere. And because CEQA says that you want to take a look at all buildings that are 50 years or more, it seems sense to do that in this context as well and to have a reasonable procedure in place in the new zoning. Now, energy facilities is a topic very important to many in Goleta, and we got a lot of good productive comments on this, some fine reading of what we had done. And again, I'm thankful for the general plan in providing some good, clear guidance. So what we do here is establish the permits and review procedures, the standards that would minimize impacts, you know, asserting that you're not doing new coastal structures, you're not doing anything to prolong the life of these legal nonconforming uses, because the plan is clear. They want them, the city would like these decommissioned and changed to a different use. We address the pipeline questions, and you'll have pipeline projects before you, I think, in the near future. And we look at decommissioning, abandonment, and removal, consistent with things. We heard at the 11th hour or 12th hour, right after we'd finished this and got it out, that we had not been sent an ordinance that looked at change of owner and operator, and we'll do that. But it's something that is pretty straightforward. It's already on the city books, and we'll fold that in. So that was the one piece of this section that we hadn't done. But I think we heard some good refinements. But I think you'll when you look at that, see that it pretty much tracks what the general plan set out. Complementing this, These development chapters are the asserting of protection for the environmentally sensitive habitats. And we want to make sure that there's a permit process and protections, no development in these areas, and that we have report submittals that are very specific on what's needed, because, and we also refer to the ESHA maps in the general plan, because some have said, well, what are these? Well, they're mapped, so the zoning ordinance would link to those general plan maps and say we need very specific biological reports when you come forward, and this has been a concern with staff that authority hasn't been spelled out specifically, along with the obligation to mitigate, to ensure that there are no adverse impacts. And we're looking at ESHA standards, stream side protection zones, the riparian wetlands, vernal pools and lagoons, all the different types of vegetation on the coastal bluffs, as well as the native grasslands, marine habitats, the monarch butterfly nesting, and the other ESHAs. And so I think you'll see that we pulled out and presented in a logical way all of the standards, the no development ideas, the setback requirements that would continue to protect these resources. For lighting, we want to restrict outdoor illumination. You don't want a lot of glare. You don't want spillover. You don't want excessive lighting and light trespass. You really want to conserve your natural resources. So this is just putting in place a lot of good practice that the DRB already uses. And we might, in fact, want to be adding to this specific requirement for lighting plans that the city has, and make sure that we're clear on the fixtures, the timing controls, shielding and filtering, and it may be important to say that they should all be fully filtered, not partially filtered. I think that would be a refinement that would make sense. And we want to establish lighting levels for the pathways and the parking and loading areas, and address all the kinds of exterior lighting conditions, and have facilities that are pedestrian-oriented. So you're getting, which means you'll have more structures, but they'll be at a pedestrian scale. And so, too, the wall-mounted fixtures will be at a pedestrian scale. Now, in the playing fields and the outdoor recreation areas, obviously, because you have large fields, you'll need taller lighting standards. So we are clear that that's an exception. And we have a number of prohibitions and exceptions and an allowance for someone to keep going with a temporary approval while they're putting in place the proper fixtures. These kinds of tables, what facilities, what has to be the shielding and the other filtering requirements are there. Now, one of the members, residents, reminded me that we didn't have the LED lighting line, and so I realized that the industry is changing, and I've got to go put that in, which we hadn't historically done, but I should have known. My wife put LED in our kitchen, so I should have known that that's something new. Performance standards are all about being a good neighbor. So while, as Commissioner Dressler knows, there are districts that deal with the air quality issues, and we have others that deal with water quality, it's still important, I think, to have in one place in the ordinance the permissible limits and some of the objective measures that you would want, and minimizing all of the operational effects. You've already done something, for example, on construction waste management. So we're relying on what you have in Chapter 8 of a different title, and we're not duplicating that, but making sure that there's no misunderstanding when someone comes in, that they have that reduce, reuse, recycle obligation for construction waste management, that you, at the same time, they'll protect industry that's down, you know, in those pockets around the airport, so that they can continue to do what they do in those industrial areas. And you want to, at the same time, make sure that you're protecting the natural environment and the residential environment. So we cover a full logical range of topics from, I mentioned, the construction, materials and waste management, air quality, dust, liquid and solid waste, hazardous materials, noise, smoke, fumes, gas, and vibration. And we'll have the noise standards table, for example, from the general plan, but also recognize that this, when you're administering this table, there may be some specific instances where the existing ambient noise conditions are higher, and you should recognize that, and the actual specific noise duration may have an effect. So there's a balancing in the details of the noise ordinance, and so what we tried to do is bring forward what I'd call a best practices ordinance on noise. Floodplain management is pretty straightforward. There's a lot of good guidance and work that's been historically done from the county and FEMA, and you want to assert again that you've got your permits, that and we all know the costs of dealing with Katrina and Sandy and all these things are very important. So anytime there would be construction in flood-prone areas, you want to have the finished floor elevations up and have other standards of construction in place to just minimize risk to property and life, and assert clearly that these are the applicant's costs. It's not a city obligation. The last big topic was one where the general plan was brief. It said enact a tree protection ordinance. So we had to look at some of the best practices and think about what makes sense, and focusing on first a definition of what are significant trees, trees of a certain width, that we would then define, have a tree protection plan when development would affect significant trees, the focus there being on the undeveloped lots, which might have stands of significant trees, and allow, though, removal if there's a situation where there's, had you required the tree be protected, the person would have no useful economic use, or if it's not a construction-related issue, but it might be that the tree is causing damage to a building, or even, and we would need to extend this to sewer lines or pathways or some other structure, and it's just time to remove that because it's causing a hazard and some cost to the homeowner. And you lastly want to make sure that during the construction process, particularly if they'd be oaks, that the practice is to protect them during construction. And you're trying always in this kind of tree protection section to balance the rights, the rights of individual property owners who might say, well, the tree's in my backyard, you're going too far, versus someone who may own a developed lot with lots of trees and taking some effort to sensitively plan to work with a landscape architect and an arborist so that the damage is minimized and the development potential is still realized. So it's that balancing of individual rights with the larger values that and benefits of trees that urban forestry provide to the community. And this is a first draft, as are all of the chapters, and so we invite your direction and comment and invite public comment on that. That's really the big, the overview of where we were with this part in Module 3, and I'd ask you to consider whether we've dealt responsibly with all of the key issues. Are there, did we miss some general plan policies? We've heard some in the written comments that we, the city has received. And I've mentioned to you before, I think it's important to balance standards with opportunities for relief in a specific instance. And I mentioned the example of noise. And are there any other concerns that we didn't fully deal with that you'd like us to come back to you with regulations at another meeting? So I could take questions now.
Mr. Diet, thank you. I would ask the commission if they had any questions for Mr. Diet at this point.
Chair, I have just a few questions.
Okay. Please, Commissioner.
In the section on the coastal zoning, the shoreline protective structures, it just wasn't completely clear. Would that include a retaining wall?
Yes.
Okay. Then skipping forward to the demolition of historic buildings. I found this a little bit confusing. So it's big page 29. So I'm at the top of the page, and it says no building permit will be issued for the demolition or removal of a building that is over 50 years old without the approval of an administrative use permit, except for the following: single-family homes and accessory structures. So that, to me, automatically exempts almost all the tract housing that's in Goleta. So is that the intention?
I didn't see.
Page 19.
Big 29?
Yeah, your page 19 on demolition of historic buildings. It's
Roman 4-19.
Yes, I see that. Okay.
So it's item B, administrative use permit required.
Yes.
You with me?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. So it says no building permit will be issued for the demolition or removal of a building that is over 50 years old without the approval of an administrative use permit, except for the following. And the first item is single-family homes and accessory structures.
Yes.
So that's exempting,
yes,
almost every home in Goleta, right?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood that correctly, and I did. And I don't know if this corresponds. Maybe it's your page, Roman numeral 4-22. In ours, it's chapter 17.34, energy facilities.
Yes.
This is just a general question pertinent. Is this drawn from the county?
Well, we have two sources here. The first source was the general plan. And where we needed additional detail on the setbacks and the numbers, we went to the coastal regulations that you adopted. You adopted a coastal ordinance and an inland ordinance. And we generally went to the coastal ordinance. And so some of the numbers are different for the coastal zone ordinance that was inherited from the county than for the inland ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the coastal ordinance and the general plan.
Okay. And the energy facilities likewise?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then, sort of continuing on there, I'm in the section on the energy facilities. It would be Roman numeral page 4-27. And so item number 7.
Yes.
Spills. So here we're talking about where pipeline segments carrying hydrocarbon liquids pass through important coastal resource areas, for example, recreation habitat, archaeological, or other areas of significant coastal resource value, automatic shutoff valves must be utilized to minimize the amount of spilled liquids in the sensitive area. The potential for damage in these areas must be minimized by considering spill volumes, duration, and trajectories in the selection of a pipeline corridor. In addition, appropriate measures for spill containment and cleanup, for example, catch basins to contain the spill and so forth, must be included as part of the required emergency response plan. My question about that is that a best practice in this area? Is that considered to be a best practice?
I would think so, but Ann knows more.
That is about best practice, and are you specifically wondering about the valves or the regulation itself?
Well, just the whole management of spills that is covered in this item.
Yeah, this is regulatory language for spill prevention. Each pipeline will have its own spill prevention plan, and then because each pipeline size differently, it has a different mix of material in it, so each pipeline needs a different type of emergency action plan, and those are multi-agency documents that are signed. If they're in the city, then the city is part of that process with the Office of Emergency Management at the county, and then the state as well. So there's a, so this is kind of high-level guidance, mm-hmm. and then each facility or pipeline will have its own spill prevention plan and emergency response plan. The valves, though, that's good to have in our regulations because that's a very important safety feature, are the automatic shutoffs.
No, I think what we heard from the community is it might be better to explain more clearly how this emergency response plan is prepared and the relationship of the city to the Office of Emergency Management and the other things. So we might have an additional phrase or two added here to clarify what this emergency response plan is if we've not adequately covered in definitions. And I mentioned earlier, we still have the definitions to do, and that's the kind of thing that we'd want to pick up so that everyone knows it's not just something that's done on an ad hoc basis, but is a fully vetted, reviewed plan that all of the, I think the states involved, as well as the county and the operators.
Okay, yeah, that's is particularly crucial given that the way that these lines are basically just almost embedded into our residential neighborhoods here. let's see. I'm almost done, Chair. I just have one more. Okay. So in the section on tree protection, I think I understand that this is supposed to apply to trees on that are part of new development. Is that correct?
It does, but it doesn't exclude trees that would be on anyone's private property, and that was a real concern from a number of speakers this evening.
How about trees that are what we call street trees?
No, it does not. There's a would be a separate title, and you have a separate committee, an advisory committee on the public trees. So this is only looking at trees on private property.
Mm. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Dyett before I open up the public hearing?
I have some questions.
Please. Commissioner?
All right. Starting with coastal access, my one question with that is looking at a map of Goleta, are we just basically talking about the Elwood Mesa, Sandpiper Golf Course, Bacara, and Vanico?
No, so, I don't think so.
Where else does the city of Goleta, except in those pieces of property, touch the coast?
Those are the three places that it touches the coast, but there may be a connection. There are other parts of the city that are in the coastal zone. So wherever there's a coastal zone, there is a map in the general plan on the trails and access ways. And I think the coastal access provisions here apply in the coastal zone, even because there may be some lateral access ways that are important. But I don't have that map in front of me.
Let me give that a try, if I might, Chair Daniels. The coastal zone, so it's correct, the part of the coastal zone that's regulated under the Coastal Act that's touching the shoreline is the Bacara property and then the two estuaries, Bell and Tecolote, and then the Elwood Onshore Facility parcel, Sandpiper Golf Course, and then Elwood, and then the Santa Barbara Shores neighborhood. And then moving down the coast a little bit, then you pick up the there's a little gap where there's nothing touching the city. And then there's that parcel south of Phelps that is by the university's North Campus development, and that's a school district parcel, and that is also within the coastal zone and the city. And then the Stark Ranch neighborhood, that is also in the coastal zone. And then some portions of the city north of Hollister on Robin Hill Road, that neighborhood in the coastal zone. And then some Old Town areas that the Rancho La Galita Mobile Home Park with the little lake that's down by Atascadero mm-hmm. Creek. And then above that, so you have the drive-in, and then you have some industrial parcels, and there's a lot of mixes of uses in there. There's a couple little residential. There's a little bit of everything in that neighborhood that's in the coastal zone. So we have a little bit of everything in the coastal zone, two mobile home parks.
But would they be required? I mean, I'm talking specifically about the coastal access provisions. There's not very many places that would be required to provide access.
Our general plan, and this will be part of what we submit to the Coastal Commission for their review, but the general plan tried to get out ahead of that by doing what the Coastal Act says. So you have to identify your coastal access, which is Haskell's Beach and the parking lot. So that's our primary, what is considered under the Coastal Act, the coastal access, the vertical access. And then it also identifies proposed future coastal access points. But those are all over on near the Elwood Onshore Facility parcel. So that's over by Bell Creek. So there's two additional, actually there's three additional coastal access points over in that area. So.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. My next question has to do with demolition, and this is a question for staff. Are there other policies that guide staff in permitting demolitions other than what will be existing in this zoning ordinance? Because if there are not, and you want to be comprehensive, you should probably address all of the asbestos-related reporting that's required in federal law. That if this is going to be a guideline for staff when they're permitting demolitions, there should probably be a sentence mentioning that reporting requirement is something to check off before something.
Yeah, that's part of the building and safety part of demolition. So there are a number of requirements under the building code of the reports that you have to make and those things that you have to fill out.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And my next question, on energy facilities, there is mention of contingency plans that have to be submitted, and it simply says they have to be submitted, but it doesn't say to whom. And that might just be something that should be clarified.
Okay.
But I mean, is it clear? Do we know who to whom we want those submitted, the contingency plans?
Yes, but I think we should add the city in because in all cases the city will be a recipient of the plan.
Okay.
Just various other agencies depending on the type of energy provider or whatever it might be.
And then there is a standard in there that says that anything that happens has to be compatible to the surrounding area. And I'm wondering if there, I mean, that seems like a little bit ambiguous. If there is some other document in which the standard by which compatibility is established. And whether you want to put it in here or you want to reference it to some other place, that by compatible, we mean this.
That's a very good suggestion. I'll deal with it somewhere.
And the last question I have is that there are provisions for repair and replacement. And it's common in other venues that have exemptions for repair and replacement that it's clear that any repair and replacement not extend the useful life of the facility. A lot of times that's dealt with. I've seen it dealt with a lot of different ways, and a lot of times it's dealt with if you come in with a repair and replacement request, it can't be more than a certain percentage of the entire facility, or it can't be the repair and replacement of something that has just grown so old and is so critical that it's actually building a new facility, something like that, just to make sure that the repair and replacement exemption is not open-ended. I mean, that's just – I was just wondering if you'd thought about that when you created the – I mean, the repair and replacement exemption is a common one and is an important when things break, you have to be able to fix them. But the repair and replacement exemption has been used in the past to completely replace an entire facility and create a whole new, brand new one. And yes. So you need to draw a line there someplace, I think. Okay. Performance standards. On page Roman numeral 4-57, you have an issue with regard to sensitive receptors that addresses the sensitive building development in nearby roadways, yes. High traffic roadways, and which is I believe is a good start on this, and it's I think it's something that needs to be addressed. One thing that I would think that you might want to do is take this language and look at other regulatory language because it simply talks about health risk assessment, but it doesn't get to the specifics as to what that health risk assessment should consist of. We had a project here recently that dealt only with cancer risk. It didn't deal with non-cancer acute and chronic health risks. And so there's actually regulatory language. You don't have to reinvent the wheel here. There's regulatory language out there in air pollution law that designates what that means. Also, I might, and this is a policy thing for staff, but I might also recommend that the health risk assessments be subject to approval by professionals who know whether the thing was done right or not. Like the Air Pollution Control District or the State Air Resources Board or somebody like that, so that you have professionals that are used to looking at health risk assessments actually do the look at them. You know, not all consultants are made equal in this. Also, I wondered if you were on a page that I think it's the next page, 58 probably. Make sure I got the right page for you here. No, it's still on 57. You have a statement that says all new commercial and industrial sources are required to use best available air pollution control technology. That's a wonderful standard and probably the most stringent one in the state at this point. And so I wondered if you were aware of that, typically the requirement for best available control technology is tied to a threshold of some level of pollutant. Now, you can require it for every new facility, which would be the most health protective, but I just wanted to raise that to your attention that that is a rather stringent standard that you've written there.
And years ago I sat on the advisory council for the Bay Area air quality, and we remember RACT,
yes,
reasonably. Well, we did consciously use BACT and not RACT here.
Oh, sure. But you made it apply to all without any kind of emissions threshold.
Well, isn't that what Goleta wants?
Well, I just wanted to make sure that
everyone knows that. I didn't mean to be flippant. I think that's...
I'm not against that, but we should approach things like that with our eyes wide open.
Right,
what
and
the
maybe
implications
we,
could be.
Maybe we need to allow some recognition of, you know, what are practical control limits. It's just like when we were dealing with the dry cleaners, you know, these de minimis sources, whatever it may be. I made a note. Thank you.
Similarly, I don't know if I've forgotten what page this is on. There's materials. On page Roman numeral 4-63, you have on smoke, fumes, and gases. You also have a very clear statement here that no use, process, or activity will produce objectionable odors that are perceptible without instruments by a reasonable person at the lot lines of a site. Okay, so you said a reasonable person. That is also more stringent than state law and local air pollution control district nuisance regulations, which typically refer to a considerable number of persons or the public. So what you've done here is you've made a single complainant able to start a regulatory process based on this zoning regulation. And so I'm not against that, because sometimes there is only one person nearby that could be bothered and they shouldn't be bothered. But I think that that is a very stringent standard, and I think that before adopting it that the staff and the City Council should have their eyes wide open about the implications of it. So that was performance standards. Finally, tree protection. I have a question for staff. Does the city currently have a policy or regulation regarding tree protection?
In our zoning ordinance, there is a section related to tree protection, but it exempts urban areas within an urban limit line.
Okay.
So that was taking, the idea was to bring some of the desires that we've heard from the community and the old regulations and stuff that issues that have come up during individual development projects with larger trees and tree removal, and trying to put them in a section that would work.
Okay, but so we're not dealing with something here that just doesn't exist at all. Okay. On the 20-inch diameter, I just have one suggestion on that. I mean, where these numbers come from, I don't know, and I'm not going to question them. On the 20-inch diameter...
Mr. Dressler?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I should clarify. There is a policy in the general plan.
Okay.
So there is some guidance for this, and a requirement to put something like this in our ordinance.
Okay, thank you. I would suggest that rather using diameter, which is usually only really measurable on a tree after you've cut it down and you have a stump to measure, that you use circumference. I mean, a 20-inch diameter is about 62.4-inch circumference. It's a lot easier to measure than it would be to guess at a diameter of a tree. So if you have people, professional tree trimmers and homeowners and everybody trying to guess what the diameter of their tree is, I think it's a lot easier to put a tape around the trunk of a tree than it is to kind of guess what the diameter of that stump would be after it gets cut.
And we always remember pi r squared.
Yeah, right. But rather than make people do math, perhaps you could go to circumference rather than diameter.
I think that's a great suggestion.
Actually, there are tapes that measure DBH diameter at breast height. So they actually, arborists use these tapes that tell you what it is. So they're special tapes.
Sure.
So you still have to put the tape around the tree, but it will tell you the circumference.
Right. And then also, does the pruning and shape-altering activities conducted by Edison to keep the limbs away from power lines require a permit under this zoning ordinance?
Probably not. The focus of this was just on the removal of significant trees.
But there's a statement in here. Let's see if I can find it. It says no significant tree can be removed, pruned, or otherwise materially altered without a permit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what Edison does believe me, because they've done it to trees in my tree in my yard, is they significantly alter and prune trees. They alter the shape of it. And so, and they go around and they do it, they're out there today.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering if under this, they would have to have a permit, and if so, they should probably be brought in and asked what they feel about that.
Just jot it down.
Okay. Those are my questions and comments. Thank you.
Any other commissioners? Madam Clerk, do we have any green sheets?
I've not received any at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Knight. Anybody else want to talk? Thank you. At this point, I'd like to open up the public hearing. And the only request to speak is Mr. Ken Knight. Mr. Knight, come on up. Welcome.
Hi. Well, I got here late for the workshop, so perhaps some of the things I might say might be a little redundant. But from an arborist standpoint, my name is Ken Knight. I'm a registered consulting arborist, and I think this tree protection plan, or the tree protection section, at least one I want to deal with, is an excellent start. There are some aspects of it that could be fine-tuned. A lot of the information, perhaps, that you could use in developing a baseline information is not in the general plan. There's not a, for example, there is information about the environmentally sensitive areas, but there's not information about specific trees. That information is available within the city, but not within planning. It's in the Public Works Department as part of a flyover that was done of the city as part of the Urban Forest Management Plan. That information was never put into the one of the layers of the general plan information because it was a different format, and also it wasn't budgeted for. So that information is there for base information as to what trees are out there, at least in terms of a flyover. It was done 2009 or something like that. So you do have access to that information, just have to go get it. A lot of the some of the information here needs further clarification. I think what happened is we have some intents from the consultant to provide specific information from an arborist perspective, but without actually having an arborist look at it. So I would propose that you have somebody like the city's contract arborist, who's also a registered consulting arborist. There's no such thing as a licensed arborist, by the way. It's a registered consulting arborist, or at least refer in your review to somebody who's done this before and who would have a lot of that information. A lot of the stuff that you have in that's proposed in here could be handled by reference to best practices. There's a lot of documents that identify not only standards from the American National Standards Institute, but also best management practices that are prepared by the International Society of Arboriculture. A lot of the intent in here is good in terms of developing a tree protection plan, and I really think that what you're trying to get at is identify what you want to do before you do it and have somebody that's knowledgeable about trees at least tell the officials as well as the owner of the property what are some possible alternatives that they could take to removing a tree. There's various mitigations you can take after a tree is done, but if you can look at alternatives before you do something, that's what you want to have, and you want to have hopefully some kind of public review of that. There's not a a process in here. It talks about you know, maybe even some cases after the fact. And it would be best, particularly in terms of emergencies, there's like a blank check in here. Well, if we made a mistake, so be it. There are risk assessment qualified people in the industry, in the consulting industry, that can help you identify what trees are most at risk and also give you alternatives as to how you can best develop your property with trees without being considered overbearing about it. So if that kind of flexibility can be written into these, I think it would make it an even better document. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Knight, quick question. With respect to diameter, breast height.
Yes.
What are your thoughts with respect to circumference versus just diameter?
We were talking about the same thing, and
yeah, right.
Ann was correct. The what the arborists use is a special tape that on one side has inches, which will give you circumference, and then the diameter at breast height. You turn the tape over, and it divides it by pi, and you get diameter at breast height.
Right.
That's the standard for the industry, which is right. Basically 54 inches off the ground.
Sure.
And you look at that.
Okay.
So if you refer to standards like that, mm-hmm. That are used by arborists in their everyday practice, it might seem strange to somebody who's, you know, like, hey, why don't you use this circumference? It's easier. But arborists do that, and it's used not only in the United States, but all over the world.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll ask one more time. Anybody else want to have any comments? All right. I'll close the public hearing. Thank you. And it's back to the commissioner. At this point, you know, I'd like to go through a number of comments that I had for staff and Mr. Diet. Is there anybody else who has got comments? All right. Commissioner Annan, would you like to go first?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Daniels. What if I have five or six again this time? Is that all right?
I'll stop you at 10.
Okay. So I'll just run through a list of areas that I wanted to bring forward. So on our page 14, we're looking on limitations of development. And in this, we're citing information on shoreline and to minimize the impact of future flooding and sea level rise. We mentioned sea level rise also in seawall prohibition, and I'm just I'm concerned how that works as far as it comes into a regulatory stance. You know, sea level rise has a various number of measurements and projections, and how do we work with that as a regulatory agency?
And not to sound like I'm punting, but that the sea level rise issue is a requirement as part of our local coastal program that will be submitted to the Coastal Commission. And so the details of what sea level rise means and where will fall as part of that project. So how that plays out will be on a separate tract. We are doing some technical studies associated with that. Looking at the steeper bluffs and then the two sloughs, Devereaux Slough and Goleta Slough, and seeing what kind of influence that might have in the city. So.
Not to contradict as well, but the Coastal Commission also has guidance on this, and we can be clear in the definitions and in this section about the reference points. And the Coastal Commission, for example, in its current guidance of last fall, lists five different sources where people can go as a starting point to get the most current mapping information for the analysis then of adaptation strategy. So we can clarify that what the director would think would be acceptable sources from the commission or other areas. So I think that's a really good point, and we would list a process for vetting the reference points.
Okay. Next one is on page 16, site planning and setback standards. This is involved references the 100-year setback, which ends up with a 100 foot plus 30. As minimum setback for new structures on the bluff. And my specific question here is, we ran into conflict with that at Sandpiper Golf Course in their redesign. The greens tee boxes were considered structures, and then there were difficulties because they were within this. Was there an exception made for recreational? I seem to remember some of that, but I wanted to understand if this was going to create a conflict there.
We were pulling the language and the setback from the general plan. The general plan is pretty detailed on what can be allowed in a bluff setback, but we'll take note on making sure that we do look at this from an accuracy standpoint and interpretation of our general plan and that policy and the golf course activities.
Because I know we worked on that, or the city worked on that at one point, and thought there was a resolution. I'm not exactly sure how that was accomplished, but I think a general 130 would run into that again, would run into that issue again. Getting there. Okay, so... protection of ESHAs, and this is on page 53, our big page 53. And I know that these languages are pulled directly from the general plan, and in this case a little bit restructured. But the ESHAs, specific ESHAs of coastal bluff scrub, coastal sage scrub, and chaparral, it seems to me that these ESHAs have a different sense about them than a lot of ESHAs do. You know, in the it's not about a specific species that can't compete or can't or is in very endangered. It's about what the function that they provide. You know, the fact that these ESHAs provide erosion control, wildlife migration, a variety of things, habitat. And yet in our definition and calling these out, is there ever a case where are these populations, but yet they're not in a significant position or quantity that makes them not subject to this? You know, because by itself, these species are not endangered. So if there's a very small, isolated area of one of these plant populations, are they still protected for the even though they're not going to accomplish this bigger value of them? I don't know if that makes sense, because, you know, stream side is by a stream, you know, wetlands is by a wetlands. These occur in variety of places, variety size and density and connectivity to other ESHAs. And it seems like there might be times where they would be identified by the species presence, but yet wouldn't perform these other functions.
So the key word is habitat. So if it's an environmentally sensitive habitat area, it needs to be an area. It needs to be habitat, and habitat has structure to it. And like you said it perfectly, that there's more going on in a habitat than just a single species, or perhaps not even a special status species. It's just the habitat function itself is a valuable resource. We don't give the minimum size. We have biologists go out and do surveys and look at the habitat for, and to see if it is a habitat. With the exception of there is a little bit of definition on size for the native grassland. Right. It's a little bit trickier on the native grassland. So that's a typical practice on habitat, is to work with your biologists to go out and to see what if it meets a certain kind of criteria and their methodologies. So that's how we look at it.
And we do have... One of the ideas was to work off the maps in the general plan. So another way to look at this is within the mapped areas, the mapped ESHAs in the general plan, if there are within those these particular species, you know, you have some chaparral or some shrub in that mapped area, then you're concerned about these kind of effects within the mapped area. It's not necessarily... any chaparral in the city. It is any, but it's in a habitat, you're saying.
Yes.
So it's chaparral in the habitat. I think that the issue you're raising warrants some clarification.
Well, if there's some relation to the habitat, has to have whatever means habitat, then that gives it some basis for size and connectivity and all these other things that create a habitat, rather than just an independent stand.
What you've just mentioned is why we like to do definitions last, to make sure that we're really getting at the tough questions that need to be defined.
Okay.
Thank you.
I do have one more question, really. And it's under hazardous materials, page 69. So we have hazardous materials under D. We talk about setbacks, transportation, those kind of things. Item number two, hazardous material or waste stored in closed containers at a facility must not be located within 50 feet of a property line. Particularly problematic if you have a property that is, you know, 75 feet wide by 200 foot deep. If it's within a property line, where do you store an item? Right in the middle of a property? So I'm trying to visualize how a set standard of a 50-foot setback for hazardous materials can function when, in some cases, there would not be, on certain parcels, that opportunity at all, and then there's impracticality in a certainly smaller parcels.
So maybe we that's where we bring in the, you know, the fire marshal or something else, so that let me talk and learn more from the city. It's a good concern.
Yeah, I just know in the industrial areas there are 75-foot wide, 200-foot deep lots, you know, 15,000, 20,000 square feet, however that. But where do you put it?
Right.
But if
you're on the edge of that industrial area, it still may make sense in the adjoining uses residential that a 50-foot setback.
If it's too residential, maybe there is some, then you could place it on the other side of the lot and still have your space from a residential. Maybe there is some way to deal with it. This one didn't suggest that it took it, that into
right,
into
right.
Account.
And I think that I can refine it.
And then the last question exactly, you know, when we go through this and matching them back and forth to the general plan, I don't know if you guys found yourselves doing that too. You know, you look at these policies, you look at the language, and you're going back and forth. When this is all said and done, and we have this here in our zoning ordinance, is all this stuff coming out of the general plan? The same language that we're seeing? In essence, it's the same language here. How does that work?
Once the ordinance is adopted, it will be consistent with what's in our general plan. And the council could choose at a future time to refine the language that's in the general plan to be less regulatory because it is mirrored in the zoning ordinance. But at this time, we're not planning on making any major edits to the general plan. It would probably be more appropriate to look at when we do our next major update to take a look at that language and see if there needs to be any modifications. It can be sort of the same, but it will be much more regulatory in the zoning ordinance than it is in the general plan. And that's the way it should be. It should be a policy in the general plan and implemented in the zoning ordinance.
But if it says this is the goal, mm-hmm. and how that is achieved is defined in the zoning ordinance, because now, if they're in both places, of course, if we change something in the zoning ordinance, we have to make a general
Absolutely.
Plan amendment
Absolutely.
Each and every time mm-hmm. that something is changed in the zoning ordinance.
Right, and that's and with development in the city, since we became a city, that's what's been happening.
Right.
Is, the general plan might need to be modified here, or the land use map has to be changed there. Ideally, once the zoning ordinance is adopted, we won't need to do that anymore because the zoning ordinance will be consistent with the general plan.
Okay. And we'll just leave all the specificity in the general plan
until council decides it's time to remove it. We had thought we might be able to do it all together, but the editing of a general plan with the language that we have in it now would be such an undertaking that we wanted to get the zoning ordinance done first and then look at whether or not we have resources left over or if we've completely burned out the Planning Commission and take some time to look at when it's time to really look at updating our general plan.
I see. And you're saying in the meantime, we're consistent, we don't have conflicts, so we don't really, it's just whenever that change comes around, then we'll be dealing with changing in two places.
Mr. Dyett, you look like you wanted to add something.
Well, I think you've touched on the real goal is once you've implemented the general plan, we carried over all that policy. It makes eminent sense to then streamline the general plan and keep it focused. But I certainly think we don't want to confuse the process now. Let's keep doing what we're doing. And then at the end, the commission could say, God, we could have definitely a general plan that's half the length because we've got a great zoning ordinance in place.
Thank you.
So just for clarity, Ms. Garman, we need the consistency. That's state requirement. It is not
absolutely. Yeah. And just for folks, there has been a lot of concern when it's talked about when would be the appropriate time to look at the general plan. And a lot of people believe that it's easier to change the zoning ordinance than it is the general plan. The general plan is limited to the number of amendments you can make per year, but it's by resolution. Whereas a zoning ordinance or any ordinance takes two reads, and there's a lot of noticing, and it's a lot of time, and there's probably more noticing with a zoning ordinance change than there is with a general plan change. Now, general plan is our bigger document, but just from a procedural standpoint, administrative standpoint, it's more involved to change an ordinance than to change the general plan. So I just wanted to point that out. So, thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, you got anything else?
That's all for me.
Thank you. I'll need clarification from staff. We have a historic committee? Yes or no? No. Will we have a historic committee? Yes or no?
At this time, I don't believe council has directed us to look at that, and there are some resource issues with who would run that. It hasn't even really been discussed, whether what department would be in charge of that committee or commission, how that would work. But it is something that one day we may get to. And there is some, I believe there's a policy in the general plan that wants us to get to that point.
At this point in time, would we then focus our effort with respect to these phase ones and phase twos, historic resource studies, to the design review board? Is that where that goes?
Yes.
You didn't sound convincing.
I'm listening.
Okay. Well, my point here is we're talking about demolition in the coastal zone and demolition of historic buildings. And what caught my eye was administrative use permit required. And then it talks about the zoning administrator, and I know that's you, but it could be others as well. Has the ability to read the phase ones and phase twos historic. I mean, that's some heavy stuff, right? And I'm just. We're talking about professionals who meet Secretary of the Engineer's historic preservation qualifications. It's something that I don't think everybody has a grasp on. I certainly don't. So I'm throwing that out as something to look at with respect to the zoning administrator. I'm sorry, that was big page 29. I'm on big page 30 now. Uh, I'm going to go backwards with, through the 1 through 6. It talks about county tax rolls. No, that's the next one. Excuse me. It talks about current market value and the cost of a rehab. Current market value, what would that be? I mean, it's really not defined anywhere. It's what is current market value? I mean, there's definitely a current value of your property taxes. I mean, is that where we're looking?
No. This point would not be assessed valuation. We would define the estimated market value as an appraisal-based value, which would either look at comps or replacement costs. It would be defined by an appraiser.
Okay. Well, that would be. It would be good to have something like that in there.
Right. Again, that's why I'm going to do the definitions.
Yeah. Understood. So assessed value is assessed value for property taxes, right? So the
yes.
last 2 years, that makes sense. An estimate from all the different experience. Okay, that's fine. Yes. Estimate market value of a property in condition. Now you're estimating, and
maybe we should say appraised, but
yeah, you see where I'm going.
Yes.
That feels wiggly. Report from a licensed engineer, nice. Okay, number one. Whether approving the application would be generally consistent with. What's generally consistent with? I mean, these are little things, but they can get big real quick if you're dealing with somebody who needs to have the X's and O's here, and generally consistent. If you look at some other language for that, something that you can a finding can actually be made on that, you know. And know that what the finding is that you made.
Okay.
Just throwing it out.
If staff could just note that this 1 through 6, these are options that the zoning administrator may consider. Doesn't have to, but may look at these different factors and making a decision for hardship.
We're going to hit on something close to what I just went through again. On big page 34, required findings, and this is in the oil and gas area. A, on page big 34, you've got a finding that I won't read at all, but the key here is it talks about proposed production is not feasible, and there's no metric on that not feasible. Somehow, some way, I mean, it's not feasible to what? I just read that, and from a zoning code enforcement look, you know, you got feasible and anything could be feasible or non-feasible, but how do you define that?
Okay.
And B is the same way, no feasible alternatives. well, and that clearly is in CEQA. And now you've got something compatible, which is good, you know, compatible to the existing and allowed rec developments and scenic resources. I mean, you know, that's something to grab onto, right? So from that standpoint, it's easy to make a plus or minus out of that. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I can tie this back to feasible as defined in CEQA, which relates to the objective. So I will fix this.
Well, it's not fixing. It's just it's getting to a point where you know we just have the ability to enforce properly with you know tools that come up and can be defined
right.
Easier.
So I want to tie feasible back to you know the objectives of the action and relate to operational. Physical and operational mm-hmm. considerations. Not that they can't make a certain amount of money. That's really what you're getting at.
No, not really.
But your question is good, and I'm glad to hear it.
You know, actually, the feasibility for CEQA is really easy. I mean, that's just a paragraph, right, somewhere. I mean, it's a paragraph in CEQA, and it's a paragraph you can pull out. Of any document and put it in here, but you know that's good. I don't know if you want the whole thing, but you know most of it is very relevant. So it sounds like you understand. Thank you. Keep going. This is big page 38. It's under oil and gas pipelines again, and we're talking about finding for development plan number one. The use of you know common carrier and multi-user is not feasible by who? You know, I mean, is not feasible. That's the same thing that I'm dealing with. I understand why you put it in there, you know, but if you're making that finding, you know, I would assume there's got to be more to that finding. Taking into account this number two. Not feasible taking into account the reasonable foreseeable need of other potential shippers. So, you know, that's kind of getting to where we need to be. You know, perhaps you would ask about having the potential shippers, you know, write a letter or something, you know, and that does it. I'm not sure. I'm just throwing that out. But you know, from that standpoint, you're giving the enforcement crew the ability to understand that there is more to that feasibility, and it's reasonable, foreseeable, and it's to a specific population. So, you know, I thought that was good. The next one, number three, the last sentence, technically feasible or the environmentally preferred route of the proposed new pipeline. That, to me, that sounds good. You would have gotten that out of CEQA, you know, because they would necessarily would have had a document. Okay. Anyway, let's move on. Appreciate your patience. Page 039, big 39. Big letter E, decisions on applications. Number one talks about it then, that this is at the bottom of the sentence in number one. A reasonable time period. Is that a minute? Is that 3 days? Where are we going with this? And shouldn't there be you know, some real time frame, you know, in that finding. You know, it's, again, you know, I think about this stuff from a zoning standpoint, and you just can't, you know, can't get your hands around this type of information.
So are you thinking of 2 or 3 years?
Well, I mean, what's the standard for these, you know, that are being decommissioned? You know, it's, you know, there's a lot. What's the one that's, you know, right next to Gaviota? I mean, that one's being decommissioned through, what, 10, 12 years? I mean, do you know, Ms. Wells?
A pipeline being decommissioned?
Oh, no, not a pipeline. I'm just talking about a whole facility. You know, the one I'm talking about at Mariposa?
I do know which one you're talking about.
Mariposa, Reina.
We also have the Elwood Marine Terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
the
so,
pipeline
I mean,
line
so they've got decades, right?
Mr. Chair, I know of oil fields in the northern Santa Barbara County that were idle for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went through several different ownerships. New owners never did anything with them. Finally, somebody bought them and decided to develop them. Mm-hmm. An asset like that, especially an asset that includes resources to be, you know, under the ground,
mm-hmm.
it can go idle for many years, and then the whole question comes up, okay, now the equipment that allows that asset to be produced, is any of that equipment operational anymore after all this time? And that question always comes up. And so now, what's the permit status? Is that stuff still permittable? I mean, it's an issue. You've put your finger on, you need to put something enforceable there, but on the other hand, if you put a hard number on there, you're going to have people come out of the public and say, well, wait a minute, you know, this type of equipment, it can stand idle for 10 years and be okay, or this type of equipment, if it's idle for 6 months, it's worthless. So it's really you know, depending on the process and the specific equipment as to whether the process can remain idle for very long and still be in a state where if a new owner comes in, they could just turn it on and it would, you know, fire back up.
And if I can clarify, the city doesn't regulate the mineral or the whatever is underground.
Right.
So if there's a lease agreement with the state that says that they have the right to whatever is under the ground, and there's no time limit on it, it makes it very difficult for us to enforce something that's going to be in conflict with the state lease. So that's why this has a reasonable period of time.
Okay. Thank you. The rest of these findings I thought were fine, really. I mean, so it's just, you know, that first one just caught me being the first one, you know. It was like, huh? You know, so anyway, we continue. Big page 45, mitigation of impacts. I just want to make sure, you know, I understand, and then maybe we can change it to however it should be. Number A, no development except as allowed in this code. Well, is this code the zoning code or the chapter? Or, I mean, is it really just the code?
The whole code, the municipal code.
The municipal code is allowed within, okay. Unless commercial plan. The next one, B, said, unless stated elsewhere in this code or general plan, new development must be sited and designed to avoid ESHAs. That's correct, right? Okay. And so I'm just, you know, I guess I perhaps maybe just the zoning code would for. Does everybody know that the code is this code here? So if we talk about the zoning code, you know, that's I think more clear.
Well, in the first page of the ordinance, we will say that this ordinance may be referred to as the zoning ordinance this code.
That would be great.
Right.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I get that. And it could be in your definitions as well. I mean, there's, you know, I understand that, you know, there's some, you just want to be consistent throughout and so just what I, you know, just what I've seen when I read this stuff. Big page 55, protection of native grasses. I'm at E right now, and removal of non-native and invasive exotic species must be allowed. Revegetation, and then I put in, of native grasslands must be with plants of, or seeds collected within the same watershed. So, and the point is, it just said revegetation must be plants or seeds. Well, revegetation of what? That's where I'm. That's, you know, just a little something. I think that's it for today. I appreciate your time, Mr. Diet.
Chair Daniels?
Yes.
I'd like to thank you for bringing up the issue of feasibility, because as you know, that's something that I'm concerned about. When I read through this, there were quite a few places where I was questioning what that meant exactly, so I look forward to the definitions. And I will put a little finer point on it than Chair Daniels did, and just I'm a couple places here where I've seen that word be used. On big page 55, that's your page 45, Chair Daniels was just talking about the removal of non-native and exotic species, and revegetation must be with plants or seeds collected within the same watershed whenever feasible. So if it costs 10 times as much, is it feasible? If it costs two times as much, or does cost not even come into that calculation of feasibility? And similar to that, you know, when it comes to mitigation of any impacts with ESHAs, you know, if there's no feasible alternative, does that include loss of profit by the developer? Does that make it infeasible? And similarly, in the stream protection areas, again, if there's no feasible alternative for siting of developments that will avoid the SPA upland buffer, does that make it infeasible? And just noting, from my experience on the Planning Commission, I've been here for 3 years now, and that's not a long time, but it's a decent amount of time. And I haven't received a staff report yet on a project with a stream protection buffer that did recommend that 100 feet. There was always something that made it infeasible, and that very well might be justified or not, but it seems to me that that definition of feasibility is extremely important, because that's something that I really, you know, have struggled with as a planning commissioner, and it's not, it is defined as in CEQA, and I have read that, but still not clear to me. So thank you for that.
Anybody else? Ms. Carmen? Nothing? I was looking at your hands if you were going to turn on your microphone or not. Ms. Wells?
We did have one more slide on next steps. So I think we talked about the next meeting possibly in August 11th for the last part of this module. We're working on the definitions with Dayot and Bhatia. And as you know from your previous meeting, we're coordinating this work with the housing element. So you may see us before August 11th with the housing element on July 28th. And we are conducting environmental review. There's a table in the foyer when you walk in. I put old meeting materials out there for the different modules, and I also put the notice of preparation for the environmental impact report. So that's out there, and Dayot and Bhatia are working on that document.
Thank you.
And I should probably use this time to just remind everybody that we're posting things on GoletaZoning.com. And we also have an email listserv for people to sign up to get notices for the Planning Commission meetings.
Thank you. And this was a discussion, so no action will be needed from the Planning Commission. So at that, knowing that, we should go on to the director's report.
Ms. Wells just gave it, so.
Wow.
I just want to thank the commission. I appreciate you taking 5 Mondays out of June to sit down with us and talk about all of these different issues. I think we've accomplished a lot this month, and I hope to not have to do this to you again this year. But I can't make any promises. We have a lot of stuff coming to you, a lot of different projects, a lot of different not only development projects, but our advanced planning projects as well, the zoning ordinance, the housing element. You name it, we're doing it. So we will continue to look at your schedules, but hopefully we can stay with the 2 meetings a month once we're back on a normal schedule. So thank you.
Thank you, Director. Any Planning Commission comments at this point?
Chair Daniels, if I could, just to, are we then planning 1 commission meeting in July? Or 2?
At this time, it's just 1.
1. The end of July?
The end of July.
The late one, 28?
Yes.
Okay.
So enjoy your time.
Is that it? I would need a motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Oh, who seconded?
I did.
Oh, I didn't hear. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? No. All right.
Pierre Porter.
5-0, clerk. Thank you.